Welcome to The More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy that we get from American politics. I am Jonah Knight. I'm an independent. I am in Maryland.
Hi, I'm Emily Brewer. I'm a moderate Republican from Virginia.
And I'm Kevin Kelton. I live in Southern California, and I'm a moderate Democrat.
And we are the crew for this this week in fantastic goings-on in this presidential campaign. And if you want to know more, then you go to moreperfectunionpodcast.com. You can go to facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast. Or if you're on iTunes, then you would rate and review, which is fantastically helpful and shows us that you love us. Love us as much as protesters love Donald Trump. Is it fair to say that these Trump rallies are an authentic turning point in this campaign, or is it just an escalation of more of the same?
Well, that's a great question. Go ahead, Em.
You know, guys, I got to say this. So first of all, so there's so many facets to all of these conspiracy theories about these rallies. But the first thing we've got going on here is Trump says, oh, it's Bernie people. Oh, it's Bernie people. Well, you know, it doesn't. I don't give a shit. Excuse my French. Because you know what? I don't care if Bernie people went there, or I don't care, because it's how the Trump people responded. And so I'm tired of hearing what he has to say about, oh, well, they incited. Well, you know, they have every right to be so, you know, just up in arms with this guy. I mean, ugh.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, a lot of people on Facebook, that's where I kind of follow the conversation, the national dialogue. A lot of people are saying, well, you know, these people don't have the right to go. And, you know, they wanted some kind of a response. They wanted to incite trouble. Hey, that's what a protest is. Mm. The Boston Tea Party, they wanted to incite a response. You know, the 1968 Democratic Convention anti-war press protesters, they wanted to incite a response. All demonstrators want to incite a response. The point is, you don't give them that. You don't give them the violent response.
Yeah. So I've been hearing commentators basically talk about how Trump himself on stage, that he's not doing enough, that he's setting the wrong tone. And they're mentioning that there's now this this warning message that's played before the events begin, and that says something like, you know, if there's a protester, just boo them or chant USA or Trump or something. But the commentators seem to be saying that this is 100% Trump's attitude on stage that is creating this environment. Do you think it's that persona and the way he's talking, or do you think it's that he's done that? Is it something else? Is it the personality of the people in this room? Have they been riled up before they've gotten there? Or how much responsibility is Trump's once the event has begun?
Wow. Well, first of all, I think it's both, but I think that the responsibility is 90% Trump's, because there's no doubt when we listen to, and they play it over and over and over on television, when you listen to the things that he said, there's no doubt that he's inciting this kind of behavior.
He's totally responsible. Totally.
Yeah. And it is a national disgrace, and he shouldn't be a presidential candidate. And the sooner that, you know, his people wake up to the fact that regardless of how much they like him or how funny they think he is or how much they want to send a message to whomever they want to send this message to, when they wake up to the reality that you can't put a man like this in the White House, it's bad for the country, you know, better off everyone will be.
Oh, you know, I totally agree. And I think the scariest thing about Trump is that, so I enjoy, and you know, maybe I'm just, you know, a glutton for punishment, but I actually read his transcripts sometimes, and how just simpleton that his transcripts are. We're going to be incredible, and we're going to make America great again, and we're going to do things with people at places. It's so basic that it's hard for me to even believe that people take this and they actually get excited about it, because he's saying essentially nothing.
Hmm. Yeah, but again, you know, we have to remember this is still a primary, and a lot of the people that are voting, some of them aren't taking this seriously, or some of them haven't thought it through. And you know, even if he gets 15 million, 20 million votes throughout the entire primaries, you need 60 million plus to be elected president of the United States. That's a big gap that he needs to bridge. And I just don't know that he's going to do that.
I guess I'm, because I watched right after the MSNBC streamed his event after the Chicago protests. And if you had a chance to see this, it was amazing. It was the thing where the first 20 minutes were just continually protesters getting up, causing a disruption. And then Trump would be on stage saying, get him out, get him out, get him out. And then yep. he'd start to say something. He'd get two sentences in, and then someone else would disrupt it. And I watched maybe 20 minutes, and it never got beyond that. It was a constant state of taking protesters out of the building. And what sort of struck me, I mean, and we know this just from listening to him at the debates and stuff, but he does not have a rich lexicon. He is not great on the stump when it comes to oration. You know, he can't. The way that he moves people is not through understanding language.
You're saying he didn't win the script spelling bee? Is that what you're telling me?
I suspect not. But I wonder if, like, in his mind, and this is just me giving him the benefit of the doubt, possibly, when he says, get him out, get him out, if he thinks that's not inciting violence. Because he's not saying, that time, beat him up or punch him, which, you know, he's maybe implied before. But if he's moved on to just get him out, does he think that that's a step up, I wonder? Because he doesn't have a grasp on language enough to be even more subtle?
That is a fantastic question, and I think you're onto something there. Well, let me just say, and then I'll let you go, Emily. I think, you know, you're kind of right in that he doesn't really always express himself as clearly as, you know, we kind of understand what he means when he kind of stumbles over thoughts. But on the other hand, you know, if you've already been in this situation three times in the last 2 days, it's a no-brainer to say, security, please deal with this. Everybody else, just stay calm. It's a no-brainer. And the man has brains. So he's clearly knows what he's doing.
Oh,
go ahead.
You know, I think the biggest, you know, I feel like the media is totally responsible for this Trump monster. I really and truly do to a large degree, because I don't think there was any, you know, intentional conspiracy theorist type feeling going on here. But what I do think is that they see a reality TV star that had great ratings. And then they see this guy, oh, he's running for president. Oh, this is going to be fun. Let's have fun with the storyline. And so, did you guys watch Chuck Todd this morning?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I don't know if you saw the Trump interview, but as Trump was sitting there, I mean, Chuck Todd was going after him on Meet the Press. I mean, he was really being very specific with his questions. He was trying to get him to answer them. And you know what? And this is, I said it earlier today, is one of the key tenets of the Republican Party, and not everyone lives by it, is personal responsibility. And he cannot step up and take any personal responsibility for his actions. He would absolutely not do it. But as Trump sat there, he looked increasingly uncomfortable.
Yep. Yep. And because his position is unjustifiable. So, you know, I do think that to go back to your first question, Jonah, it's both. It's an escalation and it's a turning point. You know, now he's gotten Bernie Sanders involved and he's trying to deflect responsibility to the Sanders campaign, which I frankly don't think is going to work. No. But I'm wondering whether, you know, I was thinking in some ways, could this help Bernie Sanders going into Tuesday? Could getting engaged in a fight with Trump actually elevate him?
Ooh, that is such a good point. Wow.
If the people that are only kind of paying attention think that the Bernie people are physically fighting the Trump people, it might, if you really hate Trump. I mean, Hillary Clinton's not out there throwing punches. But well, if Sanders gets that image of sending his troops out to fight the intolerant? Interesting.
Well, I don't think it's so much that. It's the in-between between them. I'm not expressing myself well. Just earlier, Sanders was at a town hall on CNN, and the first question was about this. And he said, look, I know this isn't a politic thing to say, but Donald Trump is an inveterate liar or a habitual liar. And, you know, that's a pretty direct blow to Donald Trump. He's going to clearly respond to that tonight or tomorrow on Twitter and on his other interviews, which means that for 24 to 48 hours, everything is going to be now about not Trump versus Cruz, not Trump versus Rubio. It's going to be Trump versus Sanders for about, you know, going into the voting on Tuesday. And like I said, that I think could elevate Bernie's credibility and stock.
Oh, that's totally spot on. And actually, something that no one really wants to talk about, but it is true, is there are people that are, you know, undecided going to the ballot box that are actually thinking, do I vote in open primary states, at least, am I voting for Trump or Sanders? So they're, they are actually sharing a group of undecided voters that could split either way. So I think you're spot on that. I think that this little Twitter battle could turn into something.
Yeah. Which, you know, kind of jumps us to a segment or a topic that's a little lower on our list. But, you know, what happens going into Separation Tuesday, as they're now calling it, on both sides, but specifically on the Democratic side? Because if Bernie wins two or three of those states, he's still going to be far behind in the delegate count. But boy, it's going to breathe new life into his campaign and kind of put hers in, you know, ECU, so ICU, whatever it is.
In Illinois, one of the things that he's been doing is attacking Rahm Emanuel, right? Former was the chief of staff, Obama's chief of staff, now mayor of Chicago, who has had tons of problems with the police there and perhaps racially motivated violence, and is he covering stuff up? And the fact that Bernie Sanders is walking into Chicago and attacking the Democratic mayor, do you think he's? I mean, first of all, I think most people would attack Rahm Emanuel for this. This appears like he's really screwed up and made some poor choices.
Yes.
But is this a conscious effort on the Sanders campaign to say, you know what, let's actually spend a day thinking about how we can reach out to the black voter?
Absolutely.
Like, yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean,
no doubt about it.
He definitely, everybody bungled, like when Black Lives Matter first got out there. O'Malley was the only one that had a good answer, and he only had kind of a good answer, and everybody else didn't even know what to do when the black people showed up to ask questions. So I don't know, but yeah, I think it is. You think?
Yeah, and if he could take, you know, a significant chunk of the black vote, and remember, it doesn't have to be 50%. If he could take, you know, 38-42% of the black vote in Chicago and the surrounding areas, that could tip the election from Hillary to him.
You know, I really think that this is actually totally calculated, and I think it's very intelligent, because I think the difference is I don't think Hillary is as comfortable attacking Rahm Emanuel as Bernie is. And I think, you know, when advisors look at stuff like this, I know when I look at things like this, I think about what is the top and bottom end of what the other candidate may be comfortable with doing. So that way it gives you an idea of what perimeters you're working within. And I don't think Hillary is going to say the things that Bernie would say. And so I think this was very calculated on his behalf, and I think it's going to help him.
Yeah, and remember, he was the first one to call for the resignation of the governor of Michigan over the water scandal. She came in second on that, and I think that hurt her in Michigan.
Oh, absolutely it did. I mean, you know, when you have such a big, big scandal going on, you've got to get out in front of those things. And she just, you know, she may have had a relationship where she thought it was better than to get into that, and he beat her to it.
You know, and another interesting thing about the Democrats, SNL did some very funny pieces last night, one on Bernie and one on Hillary. And the one on Hillary, I don't know whether you guys had a chance to see it yet, was her slowly morphing into Bernie Sanders to the point where at the end of the sketch, she actually has his white hair and glasses and a Bernie Sanders suit on as she's talking to the camera. You know, if that becomes the zeitgeist about her, if that becomes the accepted meme that she is just pandering to try to appeal to Bernie Sanders voters, that could really, you know, take away from her campaign.
Yeah. You know,
it's going to destroy it.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, I am critical of Hillary Clinton, and she's never been my first choice for anything, but I respect her. I think she's super smart, and I think that as someone who knows the law and the detail of the law, she probably has detailed plans for everything, you know. I think she's super smart. But this is the sort of thing that when I sort of see her worst-case scenario and how she's her own worst enemy, it is this kind of thing. And it's kind of, you know, the inside baseball sort of thing. But what is – you hear people talk about this. Like, what is she really – what is her identity? What is the campaign's identity? You know, just saying – because they tried early on just saying, well, I am a woman, and the fact that I'm a woman and going to be the next woman president, that means that the women will vote for me and I will win. And a lot of women got mad and said, how dare you? And so I think, I wonder if there was sort of the reliance on, I am the next one to make history. And again, going back to when she ran 8 years ago, not really having that clear vision, not really having the image ready to go. It's just, I am Hillary Clinton, and therefore I am. Just, I don't think that's, this is where she flounders.
Yep, I agree. And again, as a very strong Hillary supporter, I'm very frustrated by this because, you know, I could understand going into a campaign thinking you've got your theme locked down, but like all battle plans, they're good until they meet the enemy. And when they started to realize that that wasn't selling, you know, the three of us could sit down and in half an hour, we could come up with a new thematic for her campaign, a new reason why she's running, five things that she wants to accomplish in her first 100 days. And I don't understand if we could do that. I know I could, and I'm sure that with your help, we would make it, you know, 10 times better.
Yeah.
Why can't her people do that? Why do they let her go out and keep saying the same things over and over? And I'll give you one little example. Whenever she gets asked, you know, why are you losing so badly among the youth vote? Her stock answer is, I'm not quite sure why, but what I can tell you is you may, even if you give up on me, I will never give up on you. Now, okay, that's a nice political line, but she's been delivering that line since right after Iowa, and it hasn't changed a vote. At that point, you got to say, hey, that line isn't working, that tact isn't working. We need something else to respond to that question. But she keeps giving the same answer, and it drives me nuts.
You know what? This is the big piece here. Is you know, she was, you know, rough and tumble, and I'm sure everyone remembers in 2008 when she was taking on Barack Obama, essentially, and you know he rose at a left field, and so I think that she's, you know, playing a very conservative game of golf this time around, thinking that she's just going to ascend on the rise of superdelegates so she doesn't have to get into, you know, the quote-unquote pig pen here. But, you know, I'm not a huge fan of polling, but, you know, I follow it. And I think there's some things to be said that one of the Friday polls in the Illinois primary has Clinton up by 37, and then one that was done this afternoon has Bernie up by 2. So obviously there's a large swing. There's a large swing there, obviously. But you know, does that make people, you know, people look at these polls and they're thinking, you know, maybe I should vote for Bernie. Maybe he's got a shot. And that type of uncertainty is what's starting to manifest.
Well, actually, I think it's the other thing. I think that part of the reason that she lost Michigan was a lot of people thought she had it in the bag and they didn't turn out to vote.
And that too.
Yeah, I think there were a couple of things that happened in Michigan. I think that was one. I think I was thinking about this because in the show before Michigan, I was sort of musing about this idea, like, if Sanders goes into a disaster area and gives a speech, does he affect people better than Hillary going to Flint and talking about water? And I kind of thought he won, like, and he. And I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but I have this feeling like because he has this sort of, there's going to be a revolution. People are going to rise up. If you're in Flint, if you're in Ferguson, Missouri, you know, if you're in Chicago, Chirac, you know, that the people are going to rise up message is going to work. And I think as long as he can sort of, you know, do a little bit of rhetorical practice on including other ethnicities and not just focusing on white people. Not that I think that was conscious, but I think, you know, he's from Vermont. It's mostly white people there that need the jobs. And I think that if he has legitimately had an epiphany that, oh yeah, that's right, help everybody, then I think it's a very different game if he can communicate that effectively.
Well, I've heard some political experts talking about just this, you know, over the last week or two, and there's obviously different schools of thought. But the one that I ascribe to, and I wish I could say that this was my own thought, but actually I think Joe Trippi said it. You know, we can all sit around and say, boy, if you look at Bernie's positions, they should align really nicely with the African-American community. And, you know, there's no reason that he should be only polling 20-25% of the black vote. But there's something fundamentally about him that we probably can't put our finger on. But it's more than just, oh, he's from Vermont, or, oh, they aren't as familiar with him, or, oh, the Clintons have a 25-year relationship with the African-American community. There's something else going on that we can't yet discern, and maybe it will become apparent over time, that is that he is not clicking with these people, just as there's something going on with Hillary Clinton that she's not clicking with young women. Nobody can explain that either. But it's sometimes it's just there, you know?
You know, yeah. I think I see what you're saying, but when I look at Barack Obama, and, you know, I will always respect our commander-in-chief. I may not agree, but I'm never going to be the person to go online and, you know, destroy someone. But when I look at Barack Obama, he has a sense of a cool, calm, collected, charismatic type individual. And I think Hillary has to try very, very hard to even come close to that. I will say this, is that, you know, Bernie Sanders is rough around the edges, but I think he's a bit charismatic. I don't know if it's his accent, but there's something him that is just really, you know, interesting to watch.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think, you know, we'll have more information after the election this Tuesday. But I wonder if, you know, talking specifically about the African-American vote, is there a big difference between the African-American vote in the South and in the Midwest? You know, is Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, and Missouri, are those African-American voters substantially different than the ones in Georgia and South Carolina and Mississippi? Well, you know, I mean, maybe so.
Well, again, in Michigan, I think I have my numbers correct. I wish that Greg was here because he's better at this than I am. But I believe that he only got about 35% of the African-American vote, which is better than what he did in South Carolina, but it's still really low.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
I think the number was, I cannot remember the percentage, but out of 10 African-American votes, I believe it's 3 in 10 African-American votes went to Bernie.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. So that's still a very weak showing, even though it's better than how he did in Louisiana and South Carolina and Georgia. And, you know, he can't win a national campaign as a Democrat, you know, unless he can start attracting, you know, a substantial majority, 3 out of 4, 4 out of 5, African-American voters. One other thing I wanted to bring up while we're talking about the Democrats, and we do have to go back to the Republicans because I think we short-shrifted the other candidates with just talking about Donald Trump. But there's one thing that came up in the news this week, and I'm wondering whether either of you have heard about it, which is the latest Hillary Clinton scandal, and I want to put scandal in air quotes, which is her alleged role in this 2009 Honduras coup. Emily, have you read about that, Jonah?
I've seen very little about it. I don't think I've not seen a whole lot of major mainstream articles writing about it yet, so... Philistine, what's going on?
Okay, well, you know, I've only read one detailed article on it. Maybe I've read two, but I'm not going to be able to give you specifics with names and dates and everything. But on a high level, the alleged scandal is that in June of 2009, unbeknownst to me, I didn't even know this at the time, apparently there was a coup d'etat in Honduras and some strongman there was kicked out of office. And there's now some percolating alleged rumor that Hillary Clinton and or Barack Obama were behind this coup d'etat and that they, you know, used the CIA to remove this guy from power. And, you know, everybody can look at Allende and you can go back to even the 50s and say, of course, the CIA has done this in the past, so why not believe that it could have happened again? But first of all, there's absolutely no evidence to support it. There's zero evidence. The only thing that they can have is some cables about her reaching out to the new democratically elected president of Honduras to try to establish a relationship with him well after the coup happened. But when you think about it, you know, Barack Obama's, if nothing else, we know he's a pretty smart guy. You may hate him, you may hate his policies, but you can't think that he's not a thoughtful, reflective, informed, you know, human being. And the idea that Barack Obama, after this colossal victory going into the presidency, that he would do exactly what John Kennedy did with the Bay of Pigs, that he would attempt something like this 5 months into his presidency to overthrow some banana republic strongman for reasons that God knows why. It's just ludicrous. It's just, it does, I don't know how people can believe this stuff. It's like being a 9/11 denier. And yet, there are people, and they're mostly Sanders supporters, who are just latching on to this like it's, you know, it's Watergate.
Well, how do we know that this isn't where the origination is? I mean, I hate to say that, but...
Well, what they did was they took a couple of quotes out of one of her books, and they put a spin on them. They said, well, she, you know, she was... you know, sent a cable 4 days after the coup saying, hey, who's in charge over there? So clearly she must have had her eye on it, and she was a Secretary of State. And you know, coup d'etats don't just happen out of thin air. You know, it's that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've pulled up a little bit of it, and I was reading on it, but I'm just not seeing the smoking gun. I agree with you. I'm not seeing anything that makes me say, oh, this is it. This is Benghazi, you know?
Right. Right, but this is what the Sanders people, and frankly, all Hillary haters do. They will latch onto something, they will spin a ridiculous fictional yarn about it, and then it becomes one more notch in, you know, the anti-Hillary bedpost. And it's all built on hay. It's all made out of smoke and mirrors and hate, basically.
Yeah, I mean, my basic approach with these things is... oh yeah, there's something you want to convince me of. Give me your best shot, present your case, and if there's nothing there, then we're done with the conversation. So I'll read a thing, and if there's something there, then we can continue it, and if not, then I don't need to hear it, I guess.
Right, but unfortunately the nature of social media is it's the greatest gossip rag in the world. And it takes nothing to start a false rumor and make it a reality.
I know. I mean, you just said, Emily, like the Benghazi stuff is, as far as I'm concerned, there was no there. Like, if there was, it would have come out when all the cameras were on her at the hearing, so that somebody, some congressman or senator in the room would have gotten a big bump out of it. But they had nothing, and so I'm done with that. It doesn't exist. And now I'm waiting for, like, now someone will present the information around the email thing, and there will either be something there or they won't. And if there's not, then we move on. And I don't know.
I want to stay on this Benghazi thing and the email thing for one more minute. If you guys remember from this past Wednesday's Democratic debate, they broached the subject of Benghazi by starting with a video of the mother of one of the four slain gentlemen. I guess he was one of the security men who was killed in the Benghazi embassy attack. And, you know, God bless her. She lost her son. She has every right to grieve. No one would deny her that. But they rolled this video, and this woman was, she was rambling. She was blaming Obama and Joe Biden and Leon Panetta and Hillary Clinton. And there was one other name in there that I forget, that they all lied to her. And they, how dare they? And it's over this question of whether the video played a role, the inflammatory movie that had been put on YouTube that was anti-Muslims or something, or anti-Allah, that if that had played a role. And they build it up into she lied to the parents of these dead people. What kind of a human being? She didn't lie. She said a million times, we think that had something to do with it. And we think it was a terrorist attack. They're not mutually exclusive. And the New York Times printed an article explaining chronologically how this all came together. They have a guy who was one of the actual attackers who said, we planned this terrorist attack because of the video.
So that line of attack, that she's not qualified to be commander-in-chief because she lied to the parents of a slain service member, doesn't right. work for me at all.
Right.
Like, if my son grows up and joins the military and dies in service of this country, at no point do I expect that someone tell me state secrets so that I know exactly how he died.
Exactly.
That's ridiculous. I expect them to lie to me if my son is like this top secret covert thing and he's on a top secret mission. You should totally lie to me. I don't deserve that information.
Right. But she didn't lie. She yeah, didn't lie.
But she told them
what they believed to be the truth at the time. Emily, you're staying interestingly silent on this. I'd love to hear your opinion.
Okay. I'm going to give you my Benghazi piece in like 20 seconds, and then I'm just going to move on from it because, you know, okay. it's in the past. You know, if she was going to be, you know, brought up on charges or any of these things, it should have happened by now if that was going to happen. But at the end of the day, A, I think there was a obvious protocol breach. B, I think there was probably some lines of failed communication with intelligence. And that's where I sit on Benghazi. I think that this has happened, you know, more times than we can count in the past. I think that also we're in the world of instant information, and someone is on your ass so much quicker when things go south. Do I think there was some mistakes made? Yeah, but you know,
of course, there were.
Sensationalizing this and bringing out all these families. You know what? If someone gave, you know, a crap about these families, they'd be trying to seek out answers and not trying to take it down this dog and pony show of getting, you know, this emotionally invoking response. Yeah, I understand that's how our society works nowadays. Obviously, the rise of Donald Trump. But at the end of the day is, you know what? We've got to look back and say, okay, what did we do wrong and what can we do better?
That's what they've done after every similar attack. I mean, you know, you'd have to hold George Bush, you know, responsible for Fallujah. Obviously, we all know about, you know, the bombing in Lebanon when Ronald Reagan was president. You can't just hold these people accountable for everything that goes wrong in the world. The world is a messed up place. People die. Things happen in foreign countries where there are hostilities going on. Anyways, I think we all agree on this, so I won't take it too much further.
Yeah, should we talk about the Republicans and how?
Yeah,
and how Kasich is doing in Ohio?
Okay, so this is just for Greg, and I'm going to say quote unquote because I don't believe this, but Greg would like me to tell everybody that Kasich is an asshole, and Emily would like to say that she doesn't agree. So there, I've done it, and I hope he's happy.
For our listeners who don't know, Greg Matusik, who's one of our normal co-hosts, couldn't be with us tonight, so Emily promised to point that out because Greg does not like John Kasich,
and Emily is a strong
supporter of John Kasich. So Emily, you're a good friend for saying that.
You know
for
what?
Him.
I hope he really enjoys that. I really do. So let's talk about where things are going this coming week. Where are we at? I mean, the debate was like weak sauce. I mean, The debate was nothing.
So yeah, the last time Trump gave a measured performance in a debate, he didn't do as well immediately following, right? And I know it's early yet, but right after that debate, Rubio won D.C. and Cruz won Wyoming. So the two elections immediately following that measured debate, Trump lost. So we'll see how he does. But
we'll see. I still think he's going to win. He's going to win Florida.
I think Florida.
He'll probably win Missouri, I think. And Illinois and Ohio, he could take those too. And he's going to win North Carolina.
I think that him and Cruz will be neck and neck in Illinois. I think that he's going to blow Marco Rubio out of the water and he's going to go home crying. I think that Kasich will eke it out in Ohio. And I don't know. Things are getting kind of crazy out there. But on a side note, let's talk about D.C. for a second. So I love how the media is. You know how they obviously, carry the torch of what they want the message to be. But so in D.C., less than 4,000 votes cast on the Republican side. And Rubio ended up with 10 delegates. Kasich ended up with 9. And he was 50 votes away from him. So, you know, the headlines say, Rubio wins D.C. But, I mean, literally, he was nipping on his heels. And then Cruz and Trump were so far behind, they couldn't even, you know, scrape together one delegate. So,
yeah, it's one notch above American Samoa.
Right.
In terms of how important D.C. is. Yeah.
Exactly.
I think Rubio is done. I mean, I feel bad for the man. I even though I dislike him as a politician, he seems like a decent enough human being, and I hate to see somebody's political career flame out like this. But he's not going to win Florida, does he? I mean, where was he in the last polls? He's still like 15 to 20 points down, right?
Today's poll, actually, he was down by 23 points. 21 points. Oh, wow. I'm sorry.
Right.
Yeah. Well, are any of the... Yeah, I don't know where Rubio goes. I think... I mean, this logic of if everybody stays in, then Trump is denied a plurality. I don't know if that's going to hold up. Maybe... I think if Rubio's not there, maybe... I don't know. It's such a mess at this point.
It really comes down to, look, it's going to be Trump and Cruz. The question remains whether Trump is going to have 48% of the delegates or 42% of the delegates. And then, you know, what kind of political chops Ted Cruz has in terms of being able to put together some type of a coalition against Trump. I just mentioned this right before we started taping to Jonah that I had just learned this week. And Emily, I'm wondering whether you know about this too, that there is a rule that was passed in 2012 as part of the Republican convention rules. It's rule number 40, and it basically states that your name cannot be placed in nomination unless you've won a majority of the delegates in at least 8 states. Now, the only one that's going to be at that point, unless John Kasich amazingly catches fire after winning Ohio, the only one that's going to be at that point is Ted Cruz. So they wouldn't be able to draft a Paul Ryan. They wouldn't be able to draft a Mitt Romney, or for that matter, anyone else, unless they deal with that rule first. Did you know about this, by the way, Emily?
No, I did. I was reading up on it a couple of days ago. But, you know, here's the other thing that can happen is it's not going to stand in between any of this. And I'll tell you why is because at any point they can reduce that number as they're making rules.
Right. Well, the first thing that happens is there's a rules debate and a rules vote. That's like the first day of the convention,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
And so there will be a move to remove that, but the Trump people are going to fight that.
Well, but the question is do they have people that are players at the table? And the question is probably not, because Trump hasn't been around long enough in the Republican Party to have plants that are sitting in major seats in Republican stronghold situations. So what I think will happen is they'll move the requirement probably totally, or either they'll maybe reduce it to 2 states or something like that. But, you know, at any time, rules can be suspended, and they rewrite them for every convention, just like the Democrats do. So I think it'll, you know, obviously not have any bearing on, you know, what ends up happening. But to that point, we're in totally uncharted waters. The other thing that's going on here is that when you look at the Republican side, I don't believe, and I know DJ, God, I wish he was here, he would know this exactly, is I do not believe that this late in the game have we had this many people in. We've still had a contest going on, but we didn't have to worry about it because there weren't this many people in the race this deep going into the next races.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, are you talking about going into the convention, having this many players? Is that what you mean?
I'm talking about people still duking it out. More than, two or three people duking it out at this point, still looking for delegates. I mean,
right.
At this
point, of course, by next week, it might be just three. Yeah. By next week, it might just be three. So I'm not sure that it's really that unusual to have, more than two players, after March 15th. Maybe it is. You may be right. I'm not sure.
I'd have to look back in history because, I'm not that old, you guys.
No, I think the last time it was not really sewn up after. I mean, Super Tuesday hasn't been around for that long anyway. But right. I think Romney stumbled and Santorum won a little bit, and then Romney retooled and then won. But I think that was like after Michigan, like didn't Santorum win like Kansas or something?
Right, correct.
Yeah. So I think like aside from that, it's been the Republican nominee has pretty much gone through like Super Tuesday and then mostly been sewn up.
Right. But again, what's really going to be interesting is assuming that Trump doesn't get to 1237 or whatever their magic number is, You have a man going in who'll be the leader in delegates, but like you said, Emily, he has no connections within the Democratic Party. He has some people who have now endorsed him and are coming around to him. But does he have the smarts and does he have the people in his operation who have the smarts to know how to navigate in a convention-style setting, which is the most pure politics there is? I wrote a piece this week where, people say, there are no brokered conventions anymore. They're just, contested conventions. And I personally disagree. What I think the mistake is there are no more, smoke-filled rooms with bosses wearing, fedora hats, not fedora hats, but derby hats, sitting around a table doing it. But there are power brokers. Mitch McConnell will be a power broker. Paul Ryan will be a power broker. Most of the senators with seniority, like Lindsey Graham and John McCain, will be pulling levers. Then there will be people from the Republican Party. There's going to be a lot of politics going on behind the scenes if they get, through a first vote and Trump didn't have the delegates. And I don't know who's going to be pulling the levers for Trump.
Well, I'm hoping to be there live because I'm filing to run for a national delegate from Virginia. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we'll see. We'll have an insider seeing what's going on. But I've got to say this. So I think that Trump and his team's arrogance could possibly do him in a convention. Because, I can see him barrel into the room and saying, this is unfair, this is unfair, you're doing me wrong. And then his people, saying, well, we're going to run as an independent. And then what's going to happen? They're going to realize that he won't get on the ballot in several states because they have rules against this.
Right.
So I think that will be a preventative and a deterrent from that.
Interesting. Interesting. I just want to share one story with you, Emily. I've told this many weeks ago on the show, I think before you joined us, but Jonah may remember the story. I ran to be a convention delegate in 2012, and I even had a campaign manager. She was one of the moms on my son's baseball team, and we had worked out this whole campaign, and I wrote literature and had it printed up and cards and everything. And I went to this union hall where everybody had to go to make our pitches. And my district was allotted three male and three female delegates in 2012. So you just had to be one of the top three males to get a spot. And I lost by one vote, and my campaign manager didn't show up.
Oh, my God.
Her vote would have tied me with the guy that got the number three male slot, and – what they would have done was they would have given one of us the alt delegate you know, because they had a certain number of alt delegates, and they wouldn't have, because they wouldn't, they can't make us have a runoff, so they would have said, okay, let's make one of them an alternate delegate.
Okay,
and I would have gotten to go. So I literally
friends?
Lost by. I haven't spoken to her since.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. I mean, that's truly like a once in a lifetime experience, and you know, I'm hoping to go.
I lost by one vote. Yes, I'm hoping that you go too. You'd be great.
I'm well, you know, I'm few hoping Greg will drive up and troll me. That's what I'm hoping for.
Well, what else do we want to cover this week, gang?
Oh. I had one other thought about the Trump protester thing. I did see a brief interview with the guy who charged the stage.
Yes, I saw that.
And I do, you know, we agree that Trump is speaking in a way that is not doing himself any favors and is misleading people and is creating a bad vibe and bad energy, bad aura. But this guy who charged his stage, I think could possibly, if he starts going around giving interviews, he could be doing the same thing for the anti-Trump people. Because this guy's an idiot. And
yeah.
So the thing that my brother-in-law is a Secret Service.
Okay.
And this guy in his interview said, well, the Secret Service knew I wasn't a threat because they could see I didn't have a weapon. And this guy is so lucky he got out of there without broken bones.
Yeah.
Because the Secret Service does not screw around. And I don't know what happened for him to not get broken while rushing Donald Trump. But he then goes and gives interviews saying, well, the Secret Service knows that I wasn't really a threat, so this sort of thing is okay. And I just want to say that is not the message. that is not the message that any protester should be taking to heart. You know, if you want to go out and protest whoever, that's totally fine. Don't rush the stage. That's my
yes.
public service announcement.
Yes, and don't try to get close to any candidate. I still, you know, have a fear that there, you know, something even worse may happen between now and the November election day. I pray that I'm wrong, but I just see this spiraling in the wrong direction. So let's hope for our country that people come to their senses.
You know, what's so funny is I know you said this weeks and weeks ago, and it's like everything that you said is coming to fruition, Kevin. I swear, it's almost creepy, but I've heard it now from three people this week that said, I think that we're going to end up with, you know, a JFK-type situation. I don't even want to say the words. I mean...
Yeah, or an RFK, yeah, Robert
right.
Kennedy. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's got to be, you know, it's something that nobody wants to say, but you've got to be thinking of it. We've already had one man rush the stage. There's a lot of heat out there. There's a lot of animosity. These are very combustible candidates, and it could happen on either side. And I'm very concerned. And they need to dial back the rhetoric and dial back this, you know, anger thing
and
really
it's,
strongly.
It's the sort of thing that, like, let's say that everybody who doesn't like Trump, like, none of them are actively, you know, contemplating some kind of escalated violence. But there is the perception that violence is escalating. And if it wouldn't surprise me if it does escalate, that it's the people that feel they are being attacked by protesters
right.
that then escalate it. And this is
right.
this is ultimately, you know, going back to the beginning of the conversation, this is the potential problem with the environment that Trump has created.
Yes.
That the Sanders people are here to get us. And I don't know. Like, I think that's the
yeah.
danger.
And, you know, you can think up scenarios. We have to remember that to get into one of these indoor events, you have to go through a metal detector. You have to, you know, you can't bring a gun in there. By the way, I don't understand why Donald Trump, who thinks that there should be no gun-free zones any place. I don't understand why his events get to be gun-free zones, but that's a different story. But let's remember that waiting in line to get in or hanging out around the arena, these people could be armed to the hilt. And you could have some, you know, these militia-type people who think I'm going to go down there and look around and see if there's any protesters. And if they see people online who they think look like, you know, they're talking about being Bernie people, or they're wearing a Bernie shirt, or they've got a sign that they're folding up that says down with Trump or something, these people may take matters into their own hands. And I say that there's a 50-50 chance that, bullets get shot before the end of this campaign.
Oh, I totally agree. Actually this weekend in Virginia, there was a lady who was a Trump supporter, and supposedly they believe it was Bernie supporters that spray painted her entire house with the message.
Yeah. Right, right.
Like, this is our revolution kind of thing, and it just...
And I'll wrap it up with, you know who may be the one person in the United States who has the most control over this? Ivanka Trump. Because she seems to be the only human being he listens to. And if she can go to him and say, Daddy, this is getting out of hand. You need to now say this, this, and this, or not say that, that, and that. Hmm. She may be the only person who can actually reel him in.
Wow.
So I'm now an Ivanka Trump fan. I'm hoping that she comes through for America.
Yeah, let's start a Twitter revolution for Ivanka. Let's send her a message.
Well, guys, this has been an eye-opening conversation. And I guess we thank everybody who has listened to this, and remind us to go take a look at us on iTunes and Facebook and the blog. And hopefully many of our predictions will not come true.
Yes. Remember, America survived the Vietnam War, and the Civil War will survive even a Donald Trump presidency.
Dirty words.
Okay. Yeah. So thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Good night.